G'day and welcome to Lunch Money. Lunch Money is your social media and online home for special situations, workouts and capital raising professionals. My name is Nick Samios. I am the fund manager at Hermes Capital and I am your Lunch Money host, live stream host. I've just got a message here saying that we're having trouble streaming to Facebook. I wonder what's going on there. I'll deal with that in a minute. Today, we are going to look at selling your business and what are some of the obstacles to selling your business. And we have an expert who I'm going to introduce shortly, Andrew Cassam. And we're going to talk about what business owners can do to make their businesses irresistible. A lot of commercial finance brokers that we deal with, we primarily deal with commercial finance brokers, are from time to time asked by their clients to help them fund the purchase of a competitor or a downstream business or a horizontal acquisition, whatever it might be. I was speaking to someone the other day that was telling me that they're buying businesses because they're buying businesses that are turning over $5 and $10 million, and they're trying to aggregate those into one business that's turning over maybe $50 million, because they're of the belief that once you hit that level, all of a sudden capital raising opportunities change and you're able to really get a second wind. But look, I'm not going to talk about that right now, because what I want to do is introduce our guest, who is Andrew Cassam. Andrew is from Cassam Advisory. His primary focus is on the sale and preparation for transition of ownership of privately held businesses in the lower middle market. That generally means businesses with staff of 11 to 200, predominantly in B2B industries, such as recruitment, staffing, labor hire, wholesale, distribution, logistics. These are all industries that well and truly overlap with the industries that I'm interested in, and also most of our commercial finance brokers and other professionals that we deal with are interested in. Andrew makes the observation that less than one quarter of privately held businesses that actively seek a transition of ownership succeed. So less than one quarter of those businesses succeed. So let's welcome Andrew Cassam. G'day, Andrew.
Hello, Nick. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad at all. Listen, there's a bunch of stuff that we said we were going to talk about, but I'll just spring this one on you if you don't mind. is there something that you've been working on recently that you might tell us a bit about that helps people sort of understand what it is you do, who you do it for, and how you do it?
There's been a couple of projects recently. More of a rare instance, because my experience is that most business owners aren't looking 3 years down the track. They're generally looking 3 months down the track, if anything. So when you find someone who is thinking they're 3 years out from sale, it's actually a really good breath of fresh air. So we work with this one company to do a diagnostic of the business, identified those areas from a buyer's perspective where they might see some value detraction, certainly impediments to a sale. Going back to your comment earlier, one in less than a quarter actually sell. If this particular business owner had gone on market at that stage, he probably would not have been able to find a buyer because of those issues. So with enough time and planning, we're able to identify those issues, put various strategies in place to overcome those. And at the end of that initial 12-month period that we worked together, they were really well set up for moving ahead. And you still got the next couple of years, which is more about growing the business and growing the bottom line. And then they'll put up the for sale sign, but they'll be in really good shape at that stage. And just about to complete on a transaction, which is more of a sell side transaction, where it was someone who was almost 80, had the business for 40 something years and needed help taking it to market. And most business owners have no experience or expertise in selling a business. If they've done it once, that's great, but it's certainly better to hire a professional who's been doing it for 20 years, day in, day out. So it's taken a little bit of time, because we had a few hiccups. And actually some of the things that I'll mention today certainly pertain to that particular business in terms of impediments to a sale, but we did get over them, and we're about to complete on that. So
So it's unusual for you to get a 3 year, you know, to someone to come to you 3 years out. I guess you've got to, but that gives you plenty of time to sort of identify, as you said, the impediments and and all that sort of thing. You mentioned that someone almost 80. I've seen businesses, particularly, for example, in transport, but I guess there's other industries as well, where someone could sell the business, but then they've hung on and hung on and hung on, and then they've run out of energy, really, you know, and then the business is in decline. It's not really saleable, and all they can really do is get someone to come in and just sell a truck. And they're just getting all they're doing is realizing asset value. They're not realizing any enterprise value. I mean, is that something that you see a little bit of? I mean, I'm sure very energetic 80-year-olds. I mean, at the age of 80, you're old enough to become president of the United States, you know. But
well, this particular 80-year-old and I have been talking for 20 years, and every time we've got close to doing something, there's been a GFC or a COVID pandemic or something that's always come along to make the business. Have that side effect on the business where the earnings go down. So he was always of the opinion that the best time to sell is when everything is pumping along on, you know, on all four cylinders, which is correct to some extent. But
does that ever happen?
Can't time the market. Sorry.
I mean, I just wonder if that ever happens in the business. I mean, I say to people, there's never an ideal time to sell a business. I mean, there might be a bad time, but, you know, I've known people who, as you said, the GFC comes along, you know, they're just holding out and holding out and holding out for a better offer, and then all of a sudden, the best offer they received was the best offer they were ever going to receive, and that's gone. Yeah. You know, what I guess, you know, we've talked about, you know, the person you've been talking to for 20 years. I mean, what are some other things that you see that are obstacles to people selling their business?
Well, keeping in mind that the lower mid-market is businesses that are generally going to have somewhere between 10 and 50 staff. So they're relatively small organizations from a corporation perspective. And what is endemic really in that market is principal dependence, where the owner of the business is heavily involved on a day-to-day basis in virtually every aspect of the business. They really struggle to let go, particularly with the older generation. They've built the business up from nothing. They've started at the kitchen table 40 years ago, and they've built it up to the point where they know everything about the business, and they don't trust anybody else to, you know, to run the business the way that they would like to see it run. And so they hold on. Which is great in terms of protecting income. It's very, very hard from an energy perspective because you've got to be across everything all the time. But without systems in place, without delegation in place, without a management layer in place, it's really hard to step away. And that is probably the number one reason why a lot of business owners struggle to transition ownership away, is because taking them out of the picture would actually have a detrimental impact on the business.
Right. And any buyer can see that.
Very easy. Suppose,
someone who's 80 doesn't necessarily want to be locked in for the next 5 years. So is that your sort of top of your list for you know, making
the? Well, that's one of them. There's also the pump valuation. That's always a doozy to deal with. A business owner thinks their business is worth 10 million. It's actually worth 3. But they maintain that it's worth 10 because some guy that they were drinking with two stools down at the bar said that they should be getting 10 times revenue for their business when it's 3 times EBIT. That's always a fun one to deal with.
What would your third one be on your list?
Probably, well, it's sort of related to principal dependence in a lot of ways, is systemization, particularly those businesses that have been around for a long time. They keep on doing things the way they've always done them, and they've been slow to implement systems. And that has two effects. One is it doesn't capture the knowledge required to run the business on a sustainable basis, but it also means that they're falling behind their competitors because their competitors are more systemized, they're more agile and more responsive to clients. And so going back to your original point of decline, hanging on for too long with an old business model can contribute to a decline in earnings as well.
So when you first said systemization, I thought, because, you know, it is very related to principal dependence, but on the other hand, it also speaks to the competitiveness of the business. So let's sort of get through those top three to begin with, and then we'll see how we go. So the top three are principal dependence, the pub valuation, and systemization. So starting off with principal dependence, I mean, how, you know, you're 3 years out. I mean, are you acting as a management consultant at the same time, or how do you step someone through?
Well, normally what I do is I'd run that diagnostic to start with, and if that's identified as one of what we call a big rock, so we normally come up with three or four big rocks, and they're the key actions you can take that are going to have the most material impact on the business and its valuation and its saleability effectively. So it's often principal dependent systemization. Client concentration is another one. So a lot of smaller businesses tend to do a lot of business with one client or one small group of clients, and that's always a risk seen by buyers as well. So given enough time to de-risk principal dependence, for example, delegation is really critical. One of the things we do to start with is get them to, in detail, write their position description. Well, firstly, acknowledge that they are part of the problem, which is always fun. But to write a position description is critical, because from there we look at what can be delegated and what needs to be hired in. So, yeah, I guess to your question, there is a bit of management consulting going in there. But my major role is to identify the gaps and then bring the right resources to bear so that those gaps can be addressed. So I'm not going to profess to being the best person possibly available to consult on how to structure an organisation. What I can do is look at business through a buyer's eyes and advise, you know, that's going to be an issue down the track and probably won't get a result. So let's bring in someone. Let's find the right person, the best person we can, to advise on how to best delegate, how to best hire people in and build that management layer.
Right. So it may well be bring someone else in from the get-go. And then if you were to do that, let's say, you know, you say, look, the answer here is to reduce your dependence. We need to recruit someone who can, you know, fulfill your position description, for argument's sake. But how does that, I mean, how often is the buyer of the business wanting that role, and how often is the buyer of the business actually quite happy that they've already got a management team in place?
Well, one of the things that we do after that initial diagnostic is actually identify the buyer avatar, the buyer persona, just as you would in a marketing campaign. And so we narrow it down and say, well, this is the type of organisation or the type of buyer that we're going for. It's either a financial buyer, private equity, family office, one of those sorts of types of organisations. It's going to be a competitor, someone already in the trade, who can just bolt on what you've already got, in which case they probably won't want a management layer because they already have that within their business. It could be an international buyer. They will definitely want a management layer because they won't have people on the ground in Australia to actually do that work. And a strategic buyer, again, really depends on why they'd be buying the business and how important having a management layer in place would be to them. But it really goes back to de-risking the business, and the more dependence that the business's performance has on the owner, the more risk there is in taking that owner out. So irrespective of who's going to buy the business, the owner needs to start moving themselves away from the day-to-day, the operational side of the business, work on the business, not in the business, back, you know, quoting Michael Gerber in The E-Myth.
Yeah, I was going to say it's all E-Myth revisited stuff, isn't it? I suppose. It's interesting, you know, because, I mean, the key things, I was talking to someone the other day and they were saying that the outgoing, the vendor of the business, were, you know, if something went wrong on the production line, you know, he knew exactly where to tap the hammer to sort of make the machine start running again. So there was that sort of in-house expertise. I mean, often we think of the principal dependence as being the key relationships in terms of sales as well. Out of those sorts of things, you know, technical know-how and, say, you know, relationships and sales, I mean, what do you find the most challenging when it comes to reducing the principal dependence?
Well, it really depends on the business. The big question is, what is going to be the impact on the business if we take the owner out? So where are we going to see the problems? And it could actually be the loyalty of the staff, loyalty of the team, because they've come to join that particular individual and they've worked for that person for a long time. And I often see long-term employees, which can be held up as a bit of a trophy and saying, well, this is a positive of the business. We've had our average tenure is 20 years or whatever it is. That can actually be a detractor as well, because that's a good time to change. If someone's been with the organization for a long time, the owner leaves, they go, ooh, maybe I'll do something else.
So it might trigger sort of a lifestyle decision or a sort of a major inflection point for those people. I guess the chap I was talking to the other day was, you know, I asked him about the management. Well, a management incentive, a program. He said he was looking at a share program for key staff. I mean, is that often
an ESOP? Employee share ownership program.
And do you see that? I mean, do you ever advocate for that, or do you see that, or does it become necessary sometimes?
Again, when analysing or assessing a business, if we see the need to have golden handcuffs around some of the staff, we'd look at various ways of doing that. And that's one of the options that's available, is to have an ESOP in place. For that to work well, you need to have a good runway of time ahead of you.
Right.
So, again, going back to that example of someone who's got 3 years ahead of them before they even pull the trigger and go to sell, an ESOP could actually work really well, because people buy in or earn in to earn equity into the business. If this is a 6 to 12 month lead up to a sale process, we'd probably look at a shadow equity scheme where key people are incentivized with a share of the sale proceeds and an incentive to remain with the business to the end of whatever the transition period is that's contracted.
And you were saying, we're talking about talking about this buyer avatar. I suppose, as you say, it's any good marketing is you need to have the know what you're selling and who you're selling to and why they're buying, I suppose. In the last sort of 10 years, private equity has gone, it's just boomed. How has that changed your business? Has that impacted on your business?
Well, the only thing that's really happened there is private equity is so hungry for deals that they will actually come down into the lower mid market from time to time. And some of the funds will come down in value, but they typically like to write a check of 20 million or more, which is sort of at the upper end of the organizations I deal with. So I don't tend to come across them very much doing, because they've got that last report, $21.7 billion of dry powder in Australia at the moment, just looking to be invested. Yeah.
And it's all competing. It's all competing with each other too.
It's all competing, And IPOs are down, and some private equity funds are approaching ASX listed companies and buying and privatizing companies, because that's where they can get deals big enough to actually to deploy the capital that they've got. But what that ends up doing is it takes some of the listed companies out of the market as potential buyers of businesses in the London market as well. So I've seen that in some of the markets I deal with where, 10 years ago there was 20 potential buyers who were listed, and now there might be five.
And I'm just interested, if you mentioned, I think, for an enterprise value of, say, 20 million plus to attract the interest of private equity. So how often would you find people are buying businesses in order to get their business sort of over that threshold? Is that something people think about, or...?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the whole buy, scale, sell model. That's a pretty common one. What you'll find is that someone who's got a $10 million business will buy a $3 million business to start with, and the next one they'll do is five, and the next one after that will be 10. So as their enterprise value goes up, they buy larger businesses in order to keep that growth going, and that's how they fast-track their way to the scale that they need to get the value that they want when they exit.
Yeah, well, I guess the bigger you are, the easier it is for money to come by. And like for a $5 million business to buy a $20 million business is a little bit hard, but for a $20 million business to buy a $20 million business, it's a lot easier.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And okay, so you were saying, someone's just trying to call me here, so I'm just messaging to say I'm doing this. You were saying the next down your list was the pub valuation. And that gets back a little bit to what we were saying a little bit earlier. And I remember years ago I had a client. They were in the removal business, corporate removals. It was actually a lot bigger business than you might imagine, although very competitive. And he was looking at one of his competitors that was listed on the stock exchange, and it was trading at say a 10 times earnings multiple. So, he's gone, well, if that's trading at 10, then my business is worth, $20 million. And, of course, he's hanging on and he's hanging on and he's hanging on. And he did get a decent offer, but he passed on it because he thought he was worth a lot more. So, so this is a major impediment. How do you talk someone down from a pub valuation?
Well, we do use listed companies as an example, like as a benchmark, if you like, because their valuations are in the public domain. It's actually really easy to get that information. It's really hard to get comparable transaction data on private deals that you haven't been involved in. It's very, very rare for private companies to release transaction details, particularly around price or multiples. So it just takes time to be in that market to understand how deals are valued and how businesses are valued. But normally when you're a listed company, your capital structure is very different to a private company, obviously, and your costs are much higher as well because it costs money to be a listed company. So you can use that as a proxy, but you can't use it as a like-for-like comparison if you're not also a listed company.
No, I mean, I guess, I agree that it's totally inappropriate. I guess it's a guide for valuing a business, but of course, what the public company wants to do is they want to buy a business for a multiple of 3, and then it instantly, goes up in value as soon as they've bought it because now it's trading at a multiple of 10 or whatever it might be.
They're looking for earnings accretive acquisitions. That's key to them, and creating shareholder value. I mean, that's what they're driven to do.
Yeah.
What I often find is a listed company will buy businesses at sort of 5 times profit because they're listed at, or their market cap is based on a PE of 10 times. Yeah. So they're getting arbitrage out of the transaction. Yeah. And that makes sense. And people should be happy with that.
Yeah. So if someone sells their company to a public company for 5 times earnings and the earnings are $1 million, it's worth 5. The listed company's trading at 10 times earnings, and it's certain, just by the magic of them buying that business, it's suddenly worth 10 million. But that's life. But what I'm wondering is, you get people that, particularly, I guess, people who are, at retirement age, whatever retirement age might be these days. And they've put everything into the business. And that business is their superannuation, and they've got a number in their head. We talk about pub valuations. I guess is there also sort of the valuation I need kind of thing? Like, I really need
that comes into play, and that's one of the reasons why we do that diagnostic process to start with, from a buyer's perspective, because we're giving them data, saying, "Well, here's your risk profile. This is how a buyer would view your business. This is how they view your SWOT." If you're looking at strengths, weaknesses, opportunities and threats, this is the type of buyer that's likely to buy the business. This is how they buy. This is why they buy. If you can give them all that data, then they can make a much more, you can have a much more educated discussion with them around value and value creation than if you just simply write a number on a piece of paper and say, here you go, this is what it's worth right now. Having that depth of insight is actually critical to having that conversation with them. I had a client a few years ago now who was in the hospitality sector, and their business was very much a service business. And they instructed their accountant to model out what their business would, what the valuation would be at somewhere between 5 and 7 times EBIT. And all the way through the engagement, I struggled to understand why they had this multiple in their heads. It was only because she'd been talking to someone who had a tech business that had sold for a very high multiple.
right.
and had told her, well, I sold my business for that, therefore yours, you know, yours should be sold for that as well. And so she had that number in her head. So yeah. what ends up happening there? Look, that one just fell apart.
That's
going to happen some of the time. And when we talk about one in four actually getting the result, a lot of the reason is that's one of the reasons why a lot of people fail to sell is because they just aren't well advised, or they're poorly influenced by people who really don't know enough.
What are the sort of the major categories of motivation to sell? I remember years ago people used to talk about the baby boomers, and there was going to be this big succession issue because the population's aging and all the rest of it. I don't know that we've ever seen an avalanche of people, you know, baby boomers selling their businesses. But obviously there's people getting older. I guess sometimes the business gets too hard to handle. I mean,
there's family succession, so there is some intergenerational transfer of wealth that comes particularly within family businesses. So that's popular. Management buyouts, particularly in businesses that don't have a lot of recurring revenue, but they're good businesses. They're just good for the owner. They're not good for someone to buy.
Right.
I don't know the better way to describe that. But management buyouts tend to be popular in some sectors. Listings it's there if you're big enough and you really want to go down that path, but it's not really ideal. Then there's a trade sale or the financial sale or strategic sale. Or even liquidation to shut the doors and sell it off at asset value.
Well, like I was saying, the sort of elder transport business guys. In the end, that's all that's the option that's available is just to flog the gear.
The best valuation you're going to get is to prepare the business properly with a strategic buyer in mind. They're going to pay the most. The terms are going to be the best, and yeah, you're going to be able to move on. But particularly if you've made the business independent of the owner, should be able to move out pretty quickly.
Now, not everybody knows what you mean by a strategic buyer.
Strategic buyer is a buyer that's going to get some synergies from the acquisition. You see this a lot in tech. So, the Facebooks and Googles and those sorts of organizations, they will often buy a pre-revenue or a pre-profit company for $1 billion. Because they know if they integrate that piece of tech with what they've already got, then they're going to make $3 billion. So they're happy to give $1 billion to the vendor just because of the synergies that they'll extract from bringing that on board. Outside of the tech region, it's usually a company that specifically wants to be in a sector or wants access to a certain type of client or a certain geographical location. And they go after a business that has critical mass in that space and a good moat, a good defense strategy, so that it's really hard to compete with them, even if they start greenfield, which actually sounds appealing, but it has the lowest chance of succeeding, to buy the number one or number two player in a market. So I do a lot of work in recruitment, for example.
Right.
So if you've got a good sized finance and accounting recruiter and you want it to be in the IT market, you're better off buying a tech recruiter than trying to start a tech recruitment business within your business.
It's interesting, you use that word moat, and I did my management studies many years ago and we never had that word, but it's a word that sort of cropped up sort of recently. And particularly the youngsters love that word. so just explain moat just briefly because obviously it is we would have called it barriers to entry and all that sort of stuff, but
barriers to entry. A moat is a bit more symbolic. Obviously it's if you've got a castle and you've got a nice big moat around it, it's very, very hard for someone to storm the castle and take what you've got. Same sort of idea. If you've got a business that has really good contracts in place with its clients, if your business is dependent on its location, it's got a long-term lease, then that makes it really hard for a competitor to muscle in on your territory. If you've got really good staff that other people would want, making sure they're locked in through an ESOP or one of those types of plans. Anything that you can do, and even your branding. in your branding and positioning in the marketplace, if you've got the best Google rank, then that makes that's part of your moat because it's really hard for someone to supplant you.
Is this a word that you, is this something that you focus on with buyers? And I want with both sides. Like obviously you're on sell side, you're acting for sellers, but I guess moat is something that you're pitching.
Well, the moat concept is really important when I'm dealing with vendors as potential clients because I want to make sure that they're really good at something. They're hanging their hat on something. It's really hard to win in this world if you're a generalist. So you've got to be good at one thing and master your lane. I've heard people saying stay in your lane. It's another common saying. So building a moat is much more around as part of your business growth strategy. If you're looking at two options, one is going to make you more of a specialist and it's going to be, make your moat even more secure against one that is going to make you more of a generalist and leave you more exposed to competitive pressure, then you really should be going for the one that's going to lock your position in a lot better.
Can I ask, you mentioned before management buyout. How often would you come across a scenario where you think there's key managers are the most obvious purchasers of the business? And, I mean, are you ever facilitating that? I mean, do you sometimes go into a situation and, you go, this is a Monty for a management buyout. I mean, what are the markers of a management buyout being the best way to sell a business?
I'm generally looking for businesses that don't have a lot of recurring revenue. So it says sell it. That's great. Go and sell it again, sort of model, rather than set and forget sort of revenue streams. So again, using recruitment as an example, if you've got a business that does permanent recruitment placement and they generate their revenue through placing people on a permanent basis, then they have to keep on making placements to make money. And whilst it's great from a cash flow perspective, it doesn't have any appeal at all to buyers because an external buyer will want to know that once they own the business, that the revenue that they've seen over the last 12 months or so is still going to be there in 12 months' time. It's very hard to do that when it's relies on constant selling by key people. So in that case, it would make sense for the people who are doing the business, who are actually out there pounding the pavements and doing the sales, to take over the business in the longer term.
Right. So we're that's an interesting observation. All right. Look, we said that there were sort of three things we've talked about the pub valuation and we talked about principal dependence. You also mentioned systemization.
We talked a little bit about that earlier with again the knowledge being in the principal's head about how things are done. So it's making sure that knowledge is captured. Buyers, when they buy a business, have to think about the worst case scenario. And that worst case scenario is the day after I own it, everybody leaves and I still want to be able to run the business. So I want to know that if everyone leaves, how do I recruit these people? How do I pay them? How do I retain them? How do I train them? How do I plug in the coffee machine? There's a whole range of things that, someone coming in that hasn't had the time in the business that just needs to know, if I follow step one, step two, step three, I'll get to the outcome that I'm looking for. Now, it's not going to happen where everyone leaves day one, but it's just, when you think about systemization, it's about capturing the knowledge that's there so that could actually happen.
And is that something you guide people on, or if you go, look, it's obvious we need to create a manual for how to, is it like an operating manual for how to run this business so that?
Well, it could be software. The company I talked about earlier, they had the 3-year runway before they sell. So I did a review of all their employee contracts, their learning management system, and their policies and procedures, and it was a mess. And so I ended up suggesting that one of the best ways of dealing with those issues to start with is to put an HR information system in place and end up choosing one from a list that I gave them. And they use that as an opportunity to then re-engage with the staff around employment conditions and policies and procedures, and they put everything online on this SaaS model. new employment contracts that were standardized and were compliant and weren't full of holes like the individual ones were. And that sort of solved that particular issue. So it wasn't necessarily a manual, but it was a in place to deal with a problem that was systemic to the business.
Okay.
But oftentimes we'll go through and say, well, how much of this is documented? If the answer is, well, none of it is, well, okay, well, we need to bring someone in who specializes in, as a business analyst, in capturing knowledge and putting it into a system.
Okay, listen, I've got three more questions before we wrap up. And let's just try and get through these. So the first one would be, what is, can you think of something that's like the worst outcome, like something that surprised on the downside, and why did, you know, what sort of caused that?
In terms of when a deal fell over?
Yeah.
Really strange one?
Yeah.
I had someone die during the process once, does that count?
Well, I don't think we can solve. We can't solve that problem.
Can't solve
I'm
that
trying problem. To think. I'm thinking of something that maybe, you know, where someone didn't do what you said, and
unsigned contracts.
Right,
is always
right.
A classic. So, or even contracts that are out of date. So a company goes to, you know, wants to sell. They put all their contracts in the data room. Buyer comes in, looks at them, and says, "Well, this one expired last year. This one, expires in 3 months' time." This one hasn't been signed. It just creates a whole mess where the vending company then has to go out and either renegotiate contracts, put things in place, or step away at that point. Obviously, we put things in place subsequently to make sure that doesn't happen again. But
well, I guess if you've got 3 years, then you've got plenty of time to try it. Okay, let's go to the reverse of that question. What's an example of something where it's surprised on the upside? And what sort of caused that surprise?
There's one transaction that just comes to mind that it was a good recruitment company, but it was in that pre-GFC period where you probably remember those times, money was flowing and everything was flying off the shelves if you had enough zeros. And I just happened to know of this private equity firm out of England. And this vendor came to me and said, thinking of selling, do you know anyone? I was like, actually, I think you'd be a really good tie-up with these guys. I did two meetings,
right?
Sent a few emails, a couple of phone calls, and the deal was done.
Right.
And the vendor actually did all the work, which was really weird because normally I'm there controlling it every step of the process. And he was like, no, I got this. I'm sorted. I'm fine. And I actually couldn't impose myself on the process, but I didn't need to in the end. He just
right. So just flew off the shelves, the right buyer at the right time.
Yeah, right buyer at the right time. It was luck.
But having said that, I mean, again, if I can just sort of plug you for a second, I mean, obviously you knew the right person to speak to. I mean, it wasn't going
to right person
fly. It wasn't going to fly off the shelf itself. It's just, no. You know, it's like that thing. Oh, well, you hardly did anything. Yeah, but I've spent 30 years of my life building up that one relationship, you know.
Correct.
I mean,
there was definitely value, you know, having me involved in the process because it wouldn't happen without my involvement.
Yeah,
But the process was just so passive from my perspective. I just didn't have to do much.
But I guess Rolodex.
It was just unusual.
There must be times when Rolodex is very important, and you can't buy a Rolodex. Okay. Look, I guess the last question is, what sort of deals are in your bailiwick? What sort of stuff do you love doing, and when should people pick up the phone to you?
There's always two types of business owners who want to sell. There are those who are moving on to something else, they've found something else to invest in or something else to do with their time, that they need to sell their current business so that they can invest in the new thing, whatever that is. And they're generally motivated by how much can I get for my business? Like, what's the maximum amount I can get? Then there's a second category of business owners who have had the business for a long time. They've made a lot of money on the way through. But the people who work for them, they're like their family. You know, and they want to make sure that they're looked after and their legacy is protected. And they're less concerned about getting maximum price. They still want to get a good price, obviously, but they're not necessarily concerned about that. They're more concerned about getting a good home, finding a good home for their business to go into.
Right, right.
So either way, if someone is thinking you know, I've got this new thing I really want to dive into this AI thing or cybersecurity or something. I need to sell my manufacturing business so that I can move into that. Or if they're getting towards the end of their working life and they're thinking, I've got this great asset, this great family of staff, I really want to look after them. They might not want to sell straight away, but they're thinking, okay, the time is coming pretty soon. That's when we should be engaging. And typically, they're going to have a bottom line of sort of $1 million to $10 million is sort of the sweet spot there. So that's generally, you know, it's a time of life thing, or it's right. There's a decision coming up for a short.
So often people are wanting to find the right buyer, not just any buyer.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah, and that's why it's really important to do that profiling around what's the best fit. The best fit for one is going to be who can pay the most money. The best fit for another is who's going to be the best home.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. All right, Andrew. Well, we've our 40 minutes has flown by. I've got about another 30 questions I'd love to ask you, but I guess we've really covered some very interesting ground there. So I'm going to say thank you very much for agreeing to come on Lunch Money. It's been very beneficial, and I would remind people that you can subscribe to Lunch Money as a podcast on Apple, Spotify, etc., and maybe listen to us while you're driving around in the car if you can't catch up with us live. Andrew Casson, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for the invitation, Nicholas.
No worries. Cheers.